Get ready for a journey into the heart of Bridgeport politics with In Absentia, a new podcast from Connecticut Public's investigative team, The Accountability Project. Learn about the city's past and present political dysfunction and the systems that enable it. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts.
Funding provided by Francisco L. Borges and the Melville Charitable Trust.
This week on The Wheelhouse. We're talking about what politicians are doing for black Americans instead of what black voters are doing for politicians. For Connecticut Public, I'm Frankie Graziano. This is The Wheelhouse. It's the show that connects politics to the people. We got your weekly dose of politics in Connecticut and beyond right here. Support for President Joe Biden has dropped across all demographics, really, but notably among black voters. In a recent Gen Forward survey, nearly one in five black Americans, some 17%, said they would vote for former President Donald Trump. And 20% of black respondents said they would vote for someone else other than Biden or Trump. Today, we want to get into some of the issues on black voters' minds right now. We'll dive into, though, the why behind poll numbers. What's causing support for Biden to drop among black Americans? And we'll consider whether the Democratic Party has delivered on promises made back during the 2020 elections. With me now are three esteemed guests. This isn't a powerhouse panel that we had previously promoted somewhere else. This is bigger, I think. This is maybe a Super Bowl, World Series level, Justice League level panel that we have here. And first, I'm going to introduce the founder and president of the Narrative Project, professor of journalism and public relations at Southern Connecticut State University and Quinnipiac, respectively, Mercy Quay. Good morning, Mercy.
Good morning, Frankie. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for coming on. Jonathan Wharton, associate professor of political science and urban affairs at Southern Connecticut State University. Jonathan, thank you for coming back on The Wheelhouse.
Thank you for including me.
Always going to include you, Jonathan, the man that was most excited for us to come back here on The Wheelhouse. We appreciate you. And then, of course, the doctor, Bilal Sekou. Thank you so much for coming on, Professor. Hillier College Associate Professor of Politics and Government at the University of Hartford. Good morning.
Good morning, and go Hawks.
That's right, go Hawks. If you guys want to give us a call, you want to join in on the conversation, 888-720-9677 is the number to call if you have any questions. Jonathan, I'm going to start the conversation with you. I want to first say that we know that black Americans aren't a monolith, ideologically diverse, but in the last half century or so, something like that, a large majority of black voters have voted for the Democratic candidate. It hasn't always been that way. Go back in time, maybe before 1960, Jonathan, can you paint the picture here?
Certainly. So it's no secret that for the longest time, certainly for generations, following the creation of the Republican Party, that there's a lot of interest in that party early on, certainly because of Lincoln, Reconstruction, and there are certainly notable historians and political scientists to speak towards that. And I'll certainly pitch Eric Foner's book that really emphasizes how this took place with the elections of so many African Americans, especially in the South during the Reconstruction era. Of course, I'm also a big fan of W.E.B. Du Bois's Black Reconstruction as well, which kind of counters it and says that all the problems that were existing between both parties during Reconstruction. And then, of course, we saw the shift take place certainly during FDR's years with the New Deal and certainly with the Great Depression, where there was a big changeover in terms of interest towards the Democratic Party for African Americans. And of course, it continued further during the Kennedy and Johnson years in the 1960s. Now, many political scientists will stress that sometimes what we see in examples like this is a generational or party alignment that takes place when political parties ideologically take different stances on different issues and things do change and shift. So that this has been certainly a long time coming with certainly African Americans' interest in really both parties.
Okay, so 1960, somewhere about then, you took us to what's happened nationally that begins to sway some black voters over to support the Democratic Party.
Well, part of it was that with the passage of so many of the Civil Rights Acts, and certainly the Voting Rights Act that took place in the 1960s, that kind of pretty much sealed the interest for a number of African Americans to continue with the Democratic Party, but also for a number of white voters to change to demographically and even regionally to the Republican Party. And so we saw a greater shift there. And I certainly don't want to ignore the Reagan years in the 1980s. I mean, that really did it with the, you know, conservative and the Christian coalition that took shape.
Yeah, I'm sure there were.
Yep, go on ahead.
I'm sure there were a lot of black voters that remember the Reagan years fondly. And I say that somewhat controversially or sarcastically.
You know, it depends on who you ask, right? You know, one thing that we should emphasize, too, is some of the class dynamics that came with that during the Reagan, even the Nixon years, because, you know, there were a lot of concerns surrounding, you know, how much support there was more towards the black middle class than there was towards, you know, a low income, or at least those who are seeking social and economic uplift. So we can't ignore the class dynamics of this in the 1970s and 1980s for African Americans as well.
It sounded like I'm jumping around here a little bit, but one thing I want to underscore here is obviously it sounds like when we talk about black voters in this way, we're talking about them in sort of a block. But I promise I'm trying to do this to get into the psyche of how some people vote, because that's where the conversation should probably go rather than talking about how this president's going to get this candidate to vote for them or whatever. Right. The stuff that's more important probably is how candidate X serves the population rather than the population going to vote for that person. So all that being said, Bilal, we're going to go to 1994 here for a second, and we're going to talk about Joe Biden and the tough on crime law that ultimately led to a lot of controversy. He was really criticized by his own vice president now, but this was when they were running against each other. Tell me about the law, and do you think the law impacts that are still weighing on voters' minds?
Well, I think certainly for a lot of people who lived through that period of tough on crime, sort of rhetoric being thrown around, and actually you probably need to go back at least to the 80s when Reagan was in office, though the war on drugs actually started a decade earlier than that, but certainly it really escalated during the 80s. And then in many ways, the Clinton administration took it over the finish line, and Joe Biden was really key in Congress. I will say this much, though, that he wasn't alone. There were many members of the Congressional Black Caucus and others who were caught up in the moral panic about the damage being done by crack cocaine and the long-term implications. There was a lot of stuff. The media was at fault with articles and reports about crack babies that never materialized. And certainly violence was a problem in many urban communities. I was living in Detroit during the 1980s in high school. And back then, I mean, there was a lot of, violence. I saw drugs impact the community that I grew up in. So to some extent, that's sort of the context of, what turned out to be just really flawed public policy that came out of Congress. And Joe Biden was a leading proponent of that flawed policy. And I think that certainly he carries, some stigma, for that. He has tried, like many other lawmakers, I think, to try to walk back some of what they did during that particular era, if they're still in the public sphere. But certainly that's there, and that hangs. That's part of his legacy as a legislator. He was a big advocate of tough on crime kind of policy.
And Mercy, I want you to take us to today here, and thinking about once Democratic candidates maybe saw that they were receiving strong support from black voters, did they start to treat it like it was kind of a voting bloc, like maybe there's the support that's out there, and maybe they're thinking that they can take it for granted, or at least try to get as many votes as they can. Maybe they're thinking about it as a vote rather than their service.
Yeah, I mean, I think that when we look at politicians today, there is no obligation to the Black community or Black voting bloc. I think the obligation is a cyclical one, and it comes around every election cycle. Every 4 years, we see politicians pour into Black communities with promises, promises, promises. But those promises seldom reflect the true needs of the Black community. And by that, I mean, you know, we don't see promises that would really alleviate the issues impacting the Black community. Things like the wealth disparity between Black families and white families, things like how student loan debt impacts Black graduates far more than it affects their white counterparts. And so, you know, even in the policies that we're seeing being made from Biden as a part of his campaign promises, they don't go far enough to support Black voters. And so what we're seeing right now is paying a deep ability to pay attention to Black voters when we are needed, but less so when it comes to, all right, pay up on these promises that you've made. Coming into South Carolina, selecting South Carolina first as the first primary state really shows that we care about the Black vote to some degree, but it really starts to come off as showmanship and even pandering when the promises aren't made or aren't kept once the vote is secured.
888-720-9677, the number to call if you want to jump in and talk to us about this very important topic. 888-720-9677. I want to go to South Carolina because you brought it up, Mercy. Is that asking a lot from voters? Is it putting a lot of pressure on Black voters in particular? Because now we're saying, hey, we're going first because we want to make sure we're reaching some kind of equitable goal here.
Yeah, I guess what I would say, the word I would use here is lip service. I think what our politicians are really good at, Democratic politicians, GOP, independents, what they're really good at is paying lip service to the needs of Black voters, but we never see that pay off. And so the lip service that we see now is, let's go to South Carolina because Black voters matter to us. But if that were the case, we would see that materialize in policy, and we're not actually seeing that. I think it does put a lot on Black voters in South Carolina. When, in my opinion, I would love to hear what my fellow panelists think of this. In my opinion, I don't think Black voters in South Carolina are as representative of what Black voters nationwide feel about the election. I see, support among Black churchgoers in South Carolina for Biden remain steady when we don't see that being the case intergenerationally among the Black voting bloc across the country.
Yeah, you guys are invited to jump in now. There, you go ahead, John.
I was about to say, maybe I can chime in there with that too. Mercy's certainly onto something, because I think one thing we can't overlook is the significance of the African American church. For generations, that's been the center point for not just Black Christianity and religion, but really more importantly, is the Black political structure and system, because for so long, so many African Americans were excluded in part of the not just national and state making policy making process, but also even local government. So this has always been kind of the heart of so many African American communities. And it's no secret in the South that has been the case for generations. One thing we need to also stress too is that as much as a stronghold as important as that's been, that's certainly the Democrat Party's emphasis in terms of where they go to visit and where a lot of Black leadership has come from. And I don't want to ignore the generational dynamics with the Black church too, because some of them are older and certainly a lot of them are more socially conservative, which tends to be overlooked. Going back to your monolith point, Frankie.
Yeah. I mean, the only, couple of things I'll add to this. One, just about the shift to South Carolina. I think, the idea that the presidential nomination process should start in states like Iowa and New Hampshire every year, to me, is just nonsensical in a country that is demographically changing the way this country has changed. It just doesn't make sense. And I think the move to South Carolina was certainly, on the part of the Biden administration, obviously was an effort. I mean, that, harkens back to 2020, where South Carolina really saved his presidential bid. And in fact, had it not been for South Carolina, Joe Biden might not have gotten the nomination. And so it's quite understandable that choice of going back there, you know, what it means to him and what it means symbolically to the Democratic Party. Now, at the end of the day, a substantial portion of the Democratic Party base and the most important constituency in the Democratic Party is the Black voters that are there who have aligned themselves, as Jonathan pointed out, for generations now with the Democratic Party, even though that alignment, you started to see evidence of it, you know, shortly after 1960. So even before the passage of the Voting Rights Act, the Civil Rights Act, you started to see that migration under Kennedy, you know, and certainly picks up under Johnson to the party. And there's a reason for that. The Republican Party today is not the Republican Party of Abraham Lincoln. It is something that Lincoln would probably not recognize because it looks more like the sort of entrenched white supremacist kind of party that the Democratic Party was in the post-Civil War era. And so, you know, Black voters are pragmatic, and, you know, and Mercy and Jonathan are right. Black voters are not monolithic. There are generational differences. But at the same time, Black voters are pragmatic, you know, and so that decision to line up behind Joe Biden was one of the most pragmatic decisions that the Black community made. They looked at the two candidates, they looked at the track record of those two candidates, and they recognized that not because they were necessarily just simply Democrats who were voting the way Democrats vote, but they really looked at what they believed at the moment was in their best interest and the best interest of the country. And so they picked Joe Biden over Donald Trump. And I think at the end of the day, most Black voters will probably land in the same place. I think what Biden in particular has to worry about is a drop off, especially among 18 to 29 year olds who may not show up on election day to actually vote because they're so frustrated with politics in general, not only in terms of Biden's ability to deliver, but I think the dysfunction of our political system, which really looms large, the sort of drift towards, you know, embrace of authoritarianism and totalitarianism in our country. And it's really a frustrating moment. They're worried about the future. Will they have jobs? Will they be able to start families? Will they be able to have homes? You know, and that is an existential kind of crisis that our countries have experienced, but our young people in particular experiencing right now.
Hey, Mercy, can we workshop something together here?
Yeah, let's do it.
I'm going right off of what Bilal just said. So I think, though, a lot of people would say that it is probably a better idea to go away from Iowa and New Hampshire, right? So,
Absolutely. So
there could be good things with going in South Carolina, maybe if we don't just first go to the Black church, right? It's important to be at the Black church, but not just starting there, or, you know, we're going to make the stop every 4 years, the same kind of stop. Maybe it's getting more in the community, and then maybe it's staying in the community rather than just going there for 4 years. What other things can not just Democrats, but any kind of politician could do to try to prove that they're there for the community?
Well, I mean, you know, going back to what I originally said, I think it's not thinking about the Black community, you know, entering a slumber after the election season and then waking up from that slumber when the next one starts. I think when you do that, what the message you're sending to Black eligible voters is that's all we see you as, an eligible voter, right? We don't see you as mothers, fathers, students, professionals. We don't see you as, you know, folks either successful in your careers or maybe struggling for your careers, running the gamut, right? We don't see you as standard Americans that have issues that need to be focused on an annual and monthly basis. Every time we ignore Black communities in these 3 years in between election cycles, that's the message that we send. And so something that I would like to lean in on, especially when it comes to this generational divide that we're talking about for the Black community, is when it comes to Black eligible voters, we see that turnout tends to, and similar to other voting blocks, but turnout tends to be highest with an older demographic. We're talking about 35 and higher, right? But what we need to be really mindful of is younger voters are the ones who are enthusiastic enough to go door knock. And that's what matters for GOTV. When you don't have an enthusiastic generation of Black voters willing to knock on doors, you're really setting yourself up for failure, because that GOTV effort, that get out the vote effort, relies on an available voting class. And when I say available, folks who might not be as wrapped up in their careers as the older eligible voters. And so that's really what's important here this year, and that we're sort of seeing. Millennials and Gen Zers are really frustrated with Biden, certainly remain frustrated with Trump. And so while we're seeing a bit of a trend, and I'd like to hear from Jonathan on this one, but while we're seeing a bit of a trend from Black voters in certain states leaning towards Trump, what we're actually seeing from young Black voters is a complete disillusionment and a complete, you know, unenthusiastic affect towards politics altogether right now.
Go ahead, Jonathan. You get the last word of the segment here.
Yeah, no, and unfortunately, I'm glad Mercy brought that up. Unfortunately, it's trickling down to state and local government. I mean, I don't want to get on the platform of this because I know we're talking national politics, but it's having a carry-on effect in the sense of whether younger people are actually participating, engaging, volunteering, stepping up, running for office too, not just for national races, but for state and local. And I want to certainly stress that, unfortunately, so many younger voters, especially those under 40, are not even affiliated with the political party across the board, but it's really apparent for African-Americans. Ties has really been a disinterest for younger voters. That's been no secret, especially for Generation Y, but absolutely for Generation Z. It's only growing further in terms of the generation gap for party affiliation.
Yeah. Hey, Frankie, just really quick, I know you're going to break, but I think it's also important for us to think more broadly about the ways in which people engage the political system. I think, you know, certainly in terms of the traditional forms of engagement, like voting and maybe working on political campaigns, younger people are certainly retreating away from that kind of activity. I think a lot of Americans are in general. But on the other hand, I also encounter young people who are doing a lot of volunteer work in the community. They're engaged in different ways. And so I think it's also incumbent of us as political scientists, perhaps, to really expand our definitions of the ways in which people can become engaged. And I think, you know, the stuff that they're doing over social media, the sharing of information, I mean, all of these things are ways to be engaged that I think we need to expand how we look at and consider what political engagement actually is.
Well, I'm glad that we're talking about engagement. I'm talking about, and Jonathan, even though you think this is more of a national conversation, it can be, but we're just talking about people here. So we can obviously talk about state and local government, and we can do that in the next segment. Coming up, we're going to talk about some issues impacting Black communities right now and whether political candidates have upheld their promises for reforms. You can join in that conversation, 888-720-9677.
Support for this podcast comes from Hartford HealthCare.
Elevating Health is funded by Hartford HealthCare. The FDA has recently approved Zepbound, a new medication for chronic weight management. Dr. Davida Umashankar, Hartford HealthCare's System Medical Director of Medical Weight Loss, tells us more.
Zepbound helps decrease hunger and increase satiety levels. Taking this medication for 72 weeks, people can see at the highest dosage approximately 48 pounds of weight loss. So definitely a powerful drug and another powerful tool that we have to utilize to help individuals who struggle with obesity.
For those ready to explore their medical weight loss options, Dr. Umashankar has advice on the first most important step.
I don't think anyone knows you better than your own primary care physician. So having that conversation whenever you feel ready is so important, because these medications are quite powerful and do need to be monitored on a regular basis.
To learn more, go to ctpublic.org/elevatinghealth.
This is The Wheelhouse from Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Frankie Graziano, joined today by three amazing guests. This is a Justice League, kind of a Avengers level powerhouse panel that we have here. Bilal Sekou, Mercy Kwei, and Jonathan Wharton. And we just heard some of the history of how Black voters have shifted their support over time. But really what we're trying to do is hone in on why people vote the way that they do and the issues impacting them, and maybe it being about the voters and not necessarily about voters coming out and supporting candidate X. Let's go to today, and I'd like to start with some focus on younger generations, Gen Z and millennials. Millennial, I guess I'm one of those. You got a call. You want to talk to us here? 888-720-9677. 888-720-9677. Bilal, I'm going to go to Mercy here. Younger voters have been vocal regarding their disapproval of President Joe Biden's stance on the Israel-Hamas war. Can you talk about how this issue is influencing the millennial and Gen Z vote in this country?
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the things I'm going to go back to is student loan debt. You know, what we've seen Biden push through is about $1.2 billion for student loan relief for borrowers across the country. I'm not disaggregating that by race or demographic. That is just $1.2 billion for student loan borrowers across the country, for eligible student loan borrowers across the country. Similarly, right, when we talk about the sorts of aid or funding given towards an issue, compared to student loan relief, what we've seen Biden do is ask Congress for upwards of $100 billion to be given to Israel. I don't have the specific numbers of what has been approved, but I will say that young voters, I'm an elder millennial, shout out to elder millennials. Frankie, yeah, I think you and I share the status. Right. I think when it comes to millennials and Gen Z, what we look at when we see these numbers, right, is where Biden's priorities lie. Younger voters care a great deal about humanitarian aid internationally. They care about social justice issues here domestically, but they understand that these issues are all interconnected. And our generations are far more invested in the interconnectedness of these issues and thinking about how climate change, the impacts of climate change in Sudan might be the result of our climate practices here in the U.S. And when we don't see our politicians sort of invest heavily and deeply in these issues, what you see is a further disinterest from those generations. And I will say that when Biden is investing, and what we can say is that this is an investment in Israel, when Biden is deciding to invest billions into Israel, but not with the same authority of the pen invest into borrowers, what the message is we don't actually care about borrowers as much as we care about our foreign policy, right? About student loan borrowers as much as we care about foreign policy. And that's going to translate into the vote later this year.
I heard on CNN yesterday there was a surgeon in Gaza talking about working all the time and then not being able to feed their kids, but then the kids asking for certain things that, you know, kids ask for, like chocolate, things like that, and not being able to provide that for his child. And the surgeon was broken up about it. And of course, there's social media now, so you can see all of these things happening in real time. You can see people fleeing from bombings and trying to pick up bodies and bring them into the hospital because this person mm-hmm. needs some help. So this is brought to our door in a 24-hour news cycle here via social media. Do you think that that contributes to the way that we millennials and then I guess Gen Z generations kind of look at humanitarian issues?
Oh, absolutely. And I'll say that, you know, I'll give Gen X and even boomers credit for being a part of a society that did have a 24-hour news hole to fill in the 90s and early 2000s. But there's nothing, that is nothing compared to what we're seeing now, because that 24-hour news cycle remained on television for the vast majority of the 90s and early 2000s. Now we're seeing that infiltrate our phones. We're seeing that with push notifications and social media, right? And so that means that, you know, your neighbor who you might do lunch with as a millennial, you have a family, you're in a young community, your neighbor is now the conduit of information. Now it's not just news sources that you access when you turn on the television. You're bombarded with these messages. And so when we think about the proliferation of social media, we see, you know, a mental health crisis because of these images that millennials and Gen Zers are bombarded with every day, whereas Gen X and even boomers don't have that kind of tapped in attention paid to these international issues, unless there is a willingness from the individual in these generations to sort of buy in. But there hasn't been that kind of buy-in in a generational sense, as we've seen with younger generations, millennials and Gen Zers.
888-720-9677, the number that we offer to you to call us and talk to us this morning. Jesse from Glastonbury has a question for our panel, or maybe a comment. Go ahead, Jesse.
Careful. Hi, can you guys hear me?
I can hear you, Jesse. Go ahead.
Excellent. So we've heard a lot of talk about about promises being not fulfilled. And while I totally agree with that, I think that only tells half the story. Because on the other side of the ledger, you have a Republican Party that has made lots of promises that they have kept. And you can see that in the DEI statutes that are pretty much crossing the country at this point. In Florida, you have to get a special permission to teach about African American history from the parents. So I can't quite reconcile how, yes, Biden may not be perfect if I'm an African American voter, but I don't get to choose perfect. I have to choose between, you know, likely Biden and Trump. I think Trump will keep his promises, but his promises are to end DEI, to end all of these programs related to the African-American community. So I'm trying to understand how I can reconcile that.
Thank you for calling, Jesse. I appreciate it. Go ahead, guys.
Yeah.
Ooh,
you
know, who wants it?
Just really, really quickly, you know, one, I think the question really gets at, for me at least, the heart of why sometimes talking about the ability of Joe Biden to deliver on promises is just so much more complicated than I think we are willing to acknowledge. I mean, when we actually, we take a step back and we think about, you know, part of his original proposal, which was to cancel up to $20,000 of debt for anyone who received a Pell Grant and $10,000 for the vast majority of the remaining borrowers, and how the U.S. and how the courts intervened in that initial early effort. And the amounts are higher than I think people think they are in terms of what's been forgiven. But what's interesting about it is that Pell Grants and, you know, would disproportionately affect Black people who borrow money, especially from, you know, sort of these for-profit institutions in which people went deeply into debt. And so there are lots of people who saw lots of their loan money wiped out, right, by Biden's efforts. But I think the inability to accomplish at that sort of highest level was disappointing to a lot of people. But again, the devil is in the details. But the caller's question really for me brings to the front the importance of why we focus a lot, obviously, on the national politics and certainly the failures around criminal justice reform after, you know, George Floyd. The complexities and the dysfunction of Washington go a long way to explain why at the national level that policy failed, and not just simply the Biden administration not working hard enough or pushing hard enough. We think about voting rights. We think about the role that Manchin played in killing voting rights legislation. So there are things that have happened at the national level that explains some of the failures, but it also points to the fact that the power dynamics of our society in terms of institutional control of legislature. So Florida is able to do what they're able to do because they have super majorities in the legislature. So they're able to attack critical race theory and DEI and to rewrite the educational curriculum in a way that you can't do at the national level, fortunately. But at the same time, a state like Connecticut, which mm-hmm. is controlled by a different party, is able to restore the voting rights of people convicted of a felony on parole and have same-day voter registration, early vote. All of these things will have a disproportionate and positive impact on communities of color. So I think this is a complicated conversation to have about policy, the failure of policy being successful. And it's not just simply of a failure of desire to do the right thing but also there's real politics involved as well.
Yeah, Bilal nails it there, because Connecticut has more of a Democratic mandate here. Democrats are showing that at least they're trying to get something going here with the proper curriculum here around diversity, equity, inclusion, not just in race, but also in gender as well. They do that in Connecticut versus in Florida. The promises that we're seeing fulfilled are different kind of promises here that are more discriminatory in nature, of course. So thank you for that call, Jesse. Mercy, we talk about the student loan issue here. This is percolating. We've heard all morning, if you've been listening to NPR, they had Miguel Cardona on, who's from Connecticut, from Meriden, who is the now Secretary of Education in America, talking about the Biden administration and student loan debt and ways to try to forgive debt. Mercy, I'm tapping into your narrative project brain here, talking about the good things that you try to promote here. What about the Biden administration? Are they promoting well enough the good things that they're doing?
Oh, absolutely not. And I think one of the, when we think about public relations, I think one of the things that Biden fails at is speaking to demographics outside of just the Black community, but demographics where they are, and also using surrogates that can adequately reach those demographics. In addition to that, Biden's administration could definitely use maybe a couple workshops. Reach out to the Narrative Project if you're interested. A couple workshops on how to promote the successes that you have seen. I don't think that there is enough promotion about the fact that we do now have the first Black female Supreme Court justice, and that was a Biden appointee, right? And that was a promise that he made during the election and saw through. I think when it comes down to the way the Biden administration is able to talk about their successes, we're seeing failures across the board. And some of those failures look like, you know, straight from the podium, Corinne St-Pierre, I believe that's her name, the press secretary, correct me on her name. I think she does a fantastic job. Yep. She does a fantastic job as a mouthpiece for the administration. But I also think that sometimes her hands are tied because the information she has to communicate isn't information that young voters want to hear. They don't want to hear that you are investing again in Israel. They don't want to hear that if you are going to legislate by the pen, that you're only willing to offer $1.2 billion in student loan debt relief. And I think Bilal is completely right on this one, that Pell Grant recipients are overwhelmingly Black people, and that debt relief overwhelmingly supports the racial wealth gap, either shrinks or widens the racial wealth gap, depending on how much you're able to relieve. And something I want to go back to on what the caller just mentioned is this idea of lesser of two evils. I think it's often something that Black people and people of color broadly have to grapple with in a way that white voters never have to grapple with, the lesser of two evils. Something that Bilal said earlier, the word that I want to lean in on is pragmatic. Mm. Overall, regardless of anything, Black voters are pragmatic. And we see this in the numbers. In 2020, 90% of Black women voted for Joe Biden and Kamala Harris. In 2016, 94% of Black women voted for Hillary Clinton, right? Mm. Constantly, over and over again, we see Black women, not just Black voters in general, but Black women carrying the vote and voting in a way that is supportive to our overall issues. So when it comes down to whether we're going to vote for Biden, chances are you're going to have the majority of Black women carry the vote for Biden again. Although that doesn't say anything about his approval or about whether they're going to like that vote, or, and I'll end here, whether younger generations are going to show out in the same way.
If a voter is really feeling fed up here, Bilal, I want to go to you. What might attract a voter to take the far jump to Trump, or would they just be more likely to vote that way or sit out the election entirely?
Yeah, as I said before, I don't imagine that, you know, large numbers of Black voters will jump to support Donald Trump. I mean, I think, you know, it's very clear. I mean, he echoes the words of Nazis, his comment about, you know, the blood of the country being poisoned by immigrants and, you know, other, you know, sort of things. I think he's got a long and a well-proven record of being someone who really, for the overwhelming majority of Black people, you know, I just find it hard to imagine they'll vote for him. But I think the bigger fear that the Biden administration has is whether people will show up on Election Day and whether the enthusiasm to support Joe Biden is really there. And I think Mercy mentioned that, you know, earlier. I mean, I was talking last night to a group of people. And one of the things that I said to them is that, and I think, you know, for many Black voters, this is something we just got to come to the realization that Joe Biden is not Barack or Michelle Obama. They're gone. They're off the, they're not, well, Michelle potentially, but she says she'll never do it, could run for office. But Barack Obama is no longer running for office. We will not be able to vote for Barack Obama. And Joe Biden is what's in front of us, and that's what the pragmatic sort of option is. And, you know, for me, the choice is really clear. We're dealing with someone who, you know, stands for a democracy, who doesn't deliver everything we'd like to see him deliver, but delivers many things that have been beneficial to our community. And it is a step in a direction that is quite different from a president who says he will be, you know, the retribution of his supporters on the country, and it's nothing but grievances, and that's just not the way to go. But I'd love to throw a question at Jonathan, because I'm really interested. You know, I think, you know, in Connecticut, you have moderate Republicans like Aaron Stewart, for example, who is able to win office in a Democratic-controlled city, a city that has mostly Democrats registered, and other moderates around the state. And I'm just trying to understand what is wrong with the Republican Party at the state levels, that they're not tapping into more communities of color with more moderate sort of candidates, with, you know, advocating for issues that can really connect with voters. And I see there's a huge disconnect. The National Party is controlled by Donald Trump, but I just don't understand the state parties outside of the South, which is a whole different animal in that sense.
Well, I don't want to oversimplify it, but it's many ways similar to the Democratic Party. It is very splintered. It's very divided. And yes, it's overwhelmingly supportive of Donald Trump. And so what you're seeing is just more or less a takeover of many Trump supporters over the years. I mean, that's been no secret in Connecticut and in other states. And so, you know, that has been going on. And as far as the centrists and the moderates, there are some that still exist, but it's very difficult to make any actual changes from within it. And it's no secret, I attempted to do that when I was at least a party leader, even on state central committee there. It is not as easy as you think, but they do exist. It's not that they don't, they do. It's just the numbers overwhelmingly towards Trump supporters. And so you're seeing that more, not just in Connecticut, but in New England writ large. I do want to get back to your point too about beyond just Barack Obama or Michelle Obama, also the fact that, you know, the Bill Clintons too. I mean, you also have these centrists too, and the Blue Dogs that were once very prominent within the Democratic Party. And yet, you know, we're seeing few of them. And this kind of goes back to my original point that, you know, where does this leave moderates and centrists? And Mercy, I do want to get to one of your points that you emphasized along with Frankie. I'm especially interested in African-American men and where they are landing on these polls, because we're seeing, yeah, it might have been in the past previous elections, Donald Trump might have received maybe, let's say, you know, 48% Black support, but we're seeing now in the polls, especially among African-American men, is growing more and more, whereas the women are overwhelmingly towards Biden. So this is kind of interesting to get into some of the data beyond just generational, but also gender too.
I got to really not allow you guys to jump in at the moment here, because we do have to get in one last break here. We're having such a great conversation. Don't want to go away from it, but we'll be back right after the break. Thank you for listening to The Wheelhouse.
You're listening to the new investigative reporting podcast, In Absentia, which means you're interested in getting to the facts and uncovering the truth. If you'd like to help us continue our investigative work, consider making a donation. Visit ctpublic.org/tapsupport and contribute today.
That's ctpublic.org/TAP support. Thank you for being a part of the Accountability Project.
So, you've never donated to this station before? That's okay. Public Media Giving Days are a great time to make your first gift. Here's how.
Give now at ctpublic.org/donate.
This is The Wheelhouse from Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Frankie Graziano. We've been talking about some major issues facing Black Americans today and how these issues might impact their vote. I think it's safe to say that in 2024, many voters are feeling unenthusiastic, maybe disappointed about the state of the country. So we want to talk solutions here. We have had a great conversations with Bilal Sekou, Mercy Quay, and Jonathan Wharton here. We're going to have it be a little tighter here because we did run over some breaks here earlier. So let's get right to business here as we have about 4.5 minutes left or so. Right here in Hartford, Connecticut, very low turnout for the Democratic primaries for mayor made news. State capital, highly populated, but the voting numbers don't reflect that. So often in those cases, you might hear, well, why didn't the people in the city come out and vote? Why? Where's the urban vote? Why didn't they come out? Let's talk more about that, guys, because we are talking about state and local politics. We are talking about people not necessarily coming out to vote, but are they not maybe invited to come out and vote? Is there a party machine that might be getting in the way? Is this maybe suppression? What do you guys think?
Well, you know, I think, you know, certainly off year elections, you know, voter turnout tends to go down. I think, you know, some of this is a function of income and wealth, you know, in areas where you have higher levels of income and wealth and also education, you see the higher voter turnout. But it really speaks to the necessity of getting out into communities, meeting with people, talking about the election, you know, the kind of retail politics we've gotten away from where so much now is ads and pop things that pop up on your social media feed. And so getting out there into the communities. And I think, you know, you see an increase during presidential level election years where there's more information, more effort to turn out the vote. And so I think that's just, it has to happen in many urban communities a lot more than it does. And people need to be a lot more effective in doing it.
Mercy Quay.
Yeah, I think Bilal is completely right there. The turnout apparatus or the engagement apparatus needs to be robust and needs to look like both contemporary and traditional methods of outreach. So that looks like employing a ground game of door knocking, but that also looks like, you know, digital campaigns and social media campaigns. It looks like employing video. It looks like really diversifying the ways that you're reaching out to these communities and making it clear that we want you involved. Again, if the message being received by these communities is we only matter when you need our vote, then when you finally reach out, it's going to feel disingenuous. It's going to feel like, you know, I don't actually matter for much more than the count on a ballot. And so I think that these efforts need to be sustained. They need to be annual, perennial. They need to be seasonal. There needs to be voter turnout and voter engagement efforts in spring and in summer, right? I think efforts that we've seen in New Haven, like Democracy School and like our community town boards, these ways of getting people involved, they're proven to work. And so without these real efforts to engage people perennially and seasonally, you're not going to find that turnout is going to increase. You're actually going to find a decrease.
Jonathan.
Party competition is key to all of this, whether that's internal or even external. And so when you gather more momentum and more interest and more candidates and more political parties to be involved in the process, that's very impactful to get that turnout that you're talking towards, Frankie. Unfortunately, of course, as you alluded to, political machines, especially in many of the cities, especially in our larger cities, tend to be very prominent. There's no doubt about that. So it's very difficult to kind of break that and even find ways of, you know, getting more people involved in part of the process in many of our urban areas. And of course, you know, closed primaries are element to this too, because the primaries are critical to getting these candidates elected in the first place.
What an outstanding conversation we've had here. Can I get a final thought from each of you here and talking about what the future looks like? Maybe about 20 seconds for each of you, starting with Bilal.
For me, I'm a hopeful guy. I'm not always optimistic, but I'm a hopeful guy. And I think, you know, that there are a lot of people who are really working hard to make our democracy work. And I just want to do my part to make that, you know, happen as well.
Thank you, Bilal. And look forward to his social media and seeing some of the things he's doing, like talking to crowds with Johanna Hayes last night. Mercy, you got 20 seconds. What do you think?
I think we need to see a shift in our politics towards paying attention to issues that younger voters care about. Right now, we see two presidential candidates that are the oldest presidential candidates that we've had ever. So I think that the issues that young people care about, international affairs, domestic affairs, race, politics, and environment, they need to be minded, and they need to be minded well if we have any hope for this.
Jonathan,
future.
Really quick.
But I tend to go the opposite way, Bilal. I'm so negative now about national politics and national parties at this point. I'm just totally disengaged and disinvolved, I think, like many voters, unfortunately.
Very sorry to hear that, but we're hoping that this conversation will influence thought, not just around how people vote, but how people are reached out to by candidates and things like that. Maybe they'll do a better job in the future. Thank you so much for this great panel. I'm Frankie Graziano. Thank you so much to Chloe Wynn. And also Dylan Reyes for the show and Katie Pellico for helping out. Download The Wheelhouse anytime on your favorite podcast app. Thank you for listening to The Wheelhouse.